It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Happy Martian New Year. That's right. It's New Year's Day on Mars, which is 140 million miles from Earth. And it's being celebrated today and throughout this weekend in Mars, Pennsylvania, 25 miles north of Pittsburgh. The goal of this three-day celebration of the Red Planet with science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics activities is to encourage young people to pursue careers in these critical fields of study that will enable NASA's journey to Mars. As part of the celebration in Mars, Pennsylvania, Mars expert Jim Green, who is NASA's Director of Planetary Science, is giving a talk about NASA's journey to Mars. He also has served as a technical consultant on the upcoming feature-length movie, The Martian. And he joins us now by phone. Jim Green, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Can you first explain how the Martian New Year works? The timing is different on that planet from what we're used to on Earth.
Sure, be happy to. Well, you know, Mars is further away from the sun than we are, and so it has a longer year. And in fact, there's more than 670 days, Earth days, to equal 1 year on Mars. And Mars is great in the sense that it also has a rotational period similar to Earth's, making 1 day just a little longer than ours. It's only about maybe 40 minutes longer than ours. Now, Mars's axis is tilted, just like the Earth's, and so consequently, it goes through all the seasons, spring, summer, winter, and fall, and, of course, celebrating the time when the axis is at the right location every 2 years, two Earth years, is really a lot of fun. And it allows us to talk about what Mars is really like.
And so Mars is, again, their new year occurs every two Earth years.
Correct. So we won't be celebrating this again for another 2 years.
Man has been fascinated by Mars for centuries. Why do you suppose that there is such an attraction?
Well, for several reasons, you know, before we had telescopes, Mars was very red and very obvious from the Earth. If you have ever gone out at night and away from the city lights and knew where to look in the sky for Mars, you could easily pick it out. And that's been really exciting for humans on this planet to look at and to think about what's happening on that body. Unlike stars, stars twinkle, but at night, planets don't twinkle. And so that always made them very special. Mars actually has a funny motion as it goes across the sky. It moves forward and then back and then forward again, and that's called a retrograde motion. And that tells us that it's one of those planets that's just further away from the sun than we are.
What are some common misconceptions about Mars?
Well, a lot of misconceptions over the years, but probably the biggest and the one that's most well-known is in about 1893 or 4, Percival Lowell, who had been observing Mars for a number of years, and he was a well-known astronomer, decided that he believed he saw canals, or he could trace lines from the very nice polar cap regions of Mars to lower latitudes. And therefore, within 2 years or so after that, H.G. Wells took that idea and wrote the War of the Worlds. You know, there must be Martians on there. If there are canals that are being dug, there must be some sort of intelligent humans. And so that actually is a big misconception. Mars is unlike Earth in many ways. At one time in the past, it had an enormous amount of water. It was very Earth-like, but that has changed. Climate change has really affected what Mars looks like today over the years. It's now very arid.
Is there or has there ever been any type of life on Mars? And if so, what are the signs?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, we're in pursuit of answering that. You know, spacecraft that we have now orbiting Mars can tell us a lot about its past by looking at the geology from orbit, and we see deltas, and we see places that were ancient oceanside on the ground with Curiosity and our past rovers like Spirit, but Opportunity is also there and working. We can look and make measurements and determine that there are clays there. Clays were formed during times of water. So when you think about the past of Mars, where there was a significant amount of water, you then understand that that's a habitable world. It has potential for life. Now, although we haven't seen any evidence of a past life, we are still looking and have many plans for continuing to pursue understanding Mars to the point where we can answer that question if it has life or not in the past and maybe even today.
We've heard talk of a manned NASA mission to Mars. What would or will that consist of, and when might it happen?
Well, you know, our most recent mission was MAVEN. We launched it about a year and a half ago. It entered orbit around Mars in September of last year and is doing a fabulous job of watching how the solar wind interacts with the atmosphere of Mars. Now, the solar wind is the outgassing from the sun that occurs all the time, and it really hammers the planet because the planet doesn't have a magnetic field, and it's really unfortunately losing some of its important atmosphere to the fast-moving solar wind that goes by. Now, upcoming missions are another one that we're going to launch in March of next year. March 4th, actually, is when the window opens. It's called InSight. InSight is a beautiful lander. It's not going to roll, but it's going to plop down on the ground, and it's going to put a seismic instrument and a heat flow instrument, bury it into the Earth so that we can understand what the structure of the planet is really all about and how close a structure it is to Earth. We actually see from orbit avalanches that occur. We've captured them in our images from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been there since 2006, orbiting Mars. And that tells us that Mars may very well be active. We don't know if those avalanches are due to meteorites that hit in the area and shake the ground and loose material falls down the cliff, or whether Mars is actually shaking and therefore producing these major Mars quakes that go on, and avalanches, of course, are the result of that. So that'll tell us a lot about how active that planet currently is geologically. Right now, we are planning to have humans go to Mars to lay the groundwork to do that. We have a number of missions that are going to continue to be robotic missions. We're going to get back down on the ground. We're going to begin to extract oxygen out of Mars's intensive carbon dioxide atmosphere. We're going to look for more resources, and as we continue to do that, we then, here on Earth, are building the rockets. We're building the space launch system right now, and the Orion capsule. Those are critical elements that will propel humans into space well beyond the Earth's atmosphere, and allows us to then plan a series of missions to put humans down on the ground. We'd like to do that in the 2030s. This is really great news. I mean, it's in our lifetime. I'd love to be able to see that as soon as we possibly can.
And what kind of preparations do you need to make that possible? Because it is not an environment that is hospitable to human beings, to Earthlings anyway. So what are some of the things that need to go into the thought process for the planning of that?
Well, you know, we've been in space for many, many years, and NASA is celebrating its just celebrated a few years ago its 50th anniversary. And everything in space is trying to kill you. You know, we've had humans on the moon, and the moon is a very harsh environment. Mars is harsh. It's not as bad as the moon in many ways, but indeed it's further away, and there are other hazards that we have to take on and overcome if we're going to have humans on Mars. So some of these hazards, of course, are radiation hazards from the sun, cosmic rays, very intense particles that come from the center of our galaxy, and we're protected by our Earth's atmosphere, but in space, we're unprotected from that. But we also have some resources on Mars to use that we never had on the moon. For instance, we believe there's a significant amount of water. Water in aquifers are available for humans to be able to use, so we won't need to bring the water resources there.
It's drinkable water.
Yeah, actually, we believe it's probably drinkable.
Wow.
Yeah, we can extract whatever salts might be in it. But we do know that there has been a lot of drinkable water on Mars in the past. Curiosity is telling us that, based on the fact that it's sitting in an ancient lake bed right now, and the sediments and the deposits that it's pawed through tell us that that water could have even sustained life if microbes were growing in it.
This is fascinating. Now, the other thing that we've heard, and I don't know what the truth is to this, but or how this idea got out there, but I've heard people talking about how, yeah, we figured out how we can get human beings to Mars, but we don't know how to get them back, so that maybe the first mission is one in which someone just has to stay out there. Is that true?
No, NASA doesn't take that approach. There are some groups that are thinking about Mars as a one-way trip, but in reality, NASA won't plan it that way. Humans will have the opportunity to come back through what we're developing called a Mars Ascent Vehicle. And the Mars Ascent Vehicle will be critical to be able to be available when humans get to Mars, such that at the right time they'll be able to use it to come back, and we won't make that a one-way trip.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. We're talking with Mars expert Jim Green. He's NASA's Director of Planetary Science, and he will be in Mars, Pennsylvania this weekend giving a talk about NASA's journey to Mars. He's speaking tonight and then again on Saturday. He has also served as the technical consultant on the upcoming feature-length movie, The Martian. What can you tell us about this movie, Jim?
Well, I have to tell you, I really like the book and I really like the movie from the aspect that it's closer to what humans will actually experience on Mars than anything I've seen so far. You know, there's for those that like laser fights and fast spaceships and you know, monsters or aliens, please don't go to this movie looking for that, because you won't find it. But yet the tension is unbelievable. The excitement about how to survive on Mars and the creativeness that humans have within them to be able to survive really comes through. So I like it because it's a very human story. It's far closer to science reality than science fiction. And so therefore, you know, there's plenty of tension in our life. There's plenty of excitement in what NASA does and the astronauts that really risk their lives for us to move the species forward in terms of actually learning about our solar system and understanding what it would be like as we move off from Earth and colonize within our solar system.
I mentioned the STEAM activities that are happening this weekend, and I'm wondering if you could explain how this might encourage young people to pursue careers in these critical fields of study and how this is going to help enable NASA's journey to Mars, especially at what we hope at some point is a journey with actual human beings aboard.
Well, one of the things that my role is to talk about what Mars is really like. And as people will go and see the movie, they'll recognize that the book and the movie have a lot of elements of what Mars is really like today. And so I'm excited about telling everyone what we've learned about Mars, how we're building on that to be able to learn if there's life that exists beyond Earth. And if that's the case, then life is everywhere in our universe. Also about what are the resources that we need to bring with us, and what resources on Mars we can actually use to be able to survive on Mars. Now that means for those young people that are really excited about going into these areas that there's plenty to do. You know, do we live above ground? Do we live below ground? How do we develop habs? What kind of food can we grow on Mars? How do we sustain an environment or create an environment that humans can live and work on a routine basis at Mars? What are the things that we need to take with us in terms of tools? Those are a whole array of things that need to be created. We need to invent these things. And that I think is tremendously exciting. I mean, a lot of the science that appealed to me when we started going into space with spacecraft was all about learning new things and applying my knowledge for the benefit of mankind.
Jim Green is NASA's Director of Planetary Science, and he's giving a talk about NASA's journey to Mars called Learning to Be a Martian. You'll want to catch that either tonight or tomorrow as part of the Mars, Pennsylvania celebration of the Mars, that's the planet Mars, New Year's Day, which is something that occurs every 2 years on Mars, or once every two Earth years, that is. So it's a very special occasion. And again, Jim Green, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion, and safe travels, sir.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This Saturday, Solar Unified Network of Western Pennsylvania and the Borough of Millvale will host Allegheny Solar Fest. Like at many other summer festivals, you'll be able to enjoy live music performances, try some microbrew beer, and get a bite to eat from a number of food trucks. But one thing that's special about this festival is that it will be 100% powered by solar energy. The Allegheny Solar Fest will call attention to the significant but generally untapped potential of solar as a clean, renewable power, with exhibits from over 20 clean energy vendors, an electric car show, a climbing wall, and more. Joining us to preview the fest are Sharon Piller, she's president of SunWIPA, and Greg Winks, the lead organizer of Allegheny Solar Fest. Sharon, Greg, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. We're glad to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. How did you come up with the idea for Allegheny Solar Fest?
Well, SunWIPA, other Solar Unified Network of Western Pennsylvania, has been around for about 4 or 5 years now. And the whole idea was to unite the industry, organizations around solar. So companies that are installing solar, or solar owners, and just advocates who are want to see more solar in the region. So we thought this would be, last year was the first Solar Fest, and we thought it would be a really fun way to bring people to raise awareness about solar in the region. And so it was so much fun. We had 800 people last year. We thought we would do it again.
And clearly, one of the significant facts about the fest is that it is completely powered by solar. How did you manage this, Greg?
Well, as Sharon just described, SunWIPA is comprised of solar installation companies, manufacturing companies, especially solar companies. And we are fortunate that there are two companies within the organization that is their main business venture out there, especially one that has powered the Three Rivers Arts Festival, the Regatta. So it was just right on target as far as this is what our industry is all about, and one of our companies specializes in this, and in fact, two out of the four food trucks that'll be there will be completely solar powered. So and the other two food trucks will plug right into our solar-based generators, and that makes everything solar powered.
Is this being done anywhere else?
Not that we're aware of. Even though we're just on a small scale, just to have a festival that's completely solar generated is very unique.
And part of the point of the festival is to call attention to the potential of solar power. How would you describe that potential, and to what extent are we realizing it here in southwestern Pennsylvania?
I think that we're just embarking on this industry here, and we're far behind other states.
I was going to say, didn't Jimmy Carter put solar panels
yes,
on the White House?
He did, and yeah. They were unfortunately taken off, but President Obama has put them back on there.
Right, so it's kind of been, which really it symbolizes the whole solar movement. It's kind of gone in fits and starts, hasn't it?
Which is no longer the truth. That's no longer the case anymore. So what we're seeing is this explosion of solar over the last 5 years across the country. And now solar is really the fastest growing energy source around the world. And we see this happening and exploding in other markets. And Pennsylvania actually was a leader in solar energy a few years ago. We were the third or fourth leading solar state. And now we've unfortunately dropped to about 12th. But we don't see any slowdown. The amount of solar increases about 30% every year. So we're really in this sea change of energy use.
And I think that's another purpose of Solar Fest itself, is just to make the awareness to Western Pennsylvania that solar energy is viable in this region and it is affordable. So people can come out and they can talk and engage with the various installation companies and get word right straight from the horse's mouth that it works.
Now, we've had a stretch of cloudy days or hazy days where there's been some sun, but, you know, we've had a lot of rain lately and a lot of June gloom. So when that happens, I'm sure people wonder, well, if I had solar panels on my house, would I be getting the energy that I need? So when the sun goes away, as it has, does that pose problems?
Well, even on a cloudy day, we're still producing solar energy here. And in fact, Germany, which is the leading solar nation, gets about as much sun as Alaska. So we know in Western Pennsylvania, we get a lot more sun than Alaska does. And the potential for solar energy here is much greater. So it works very well here. We can produce as much sun here in Western Pennsylvania as you do it on a house in Arizona just by adding an extra solar panel or two.
In terms of the timing of this, you could not have planned it this way, but this week we've been hearing from the Pope about climate change. And certainly one of the ways to mitigate the effects of that is with renewable energy. So I'm sure you're following the news and thinking, hey, this is a great time to be having this event and having this conversation.
Absolutely. And the fact that clean energy ties into our environment, we've seen and read a lot of studies locally how the particle pollution in our local environment has led to increased rates of asthma and heart and lung disease. Well, the largest generator of air pollution is the generation of electricity. So
it's the coal fired plant.
Right.
That's right.
And so, the Pope's announcement this week does tie in with our message as far as long term, viable, renewable, clean energy generation sources. And that's the message with solar.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Greg Winks. He's the lead organizer of the Allegheny Solar Fest. And also with us is Sharon Piller. She's president of SunWIPA, Solar Unified Network of Western Pennsylvania. And lately, when we hear about technology and energy production, we're probably most likely to be hearing about hydraulic fracturing that has taken hold in the region. Has fracking drawn attention away from solar development, do you think?
I think in this region there is, that is definitely a focus. And Western Pennsylvania has been known as a energy hub of the country. And so what we'd like to see is that energy hub also include clean energy, or actually really be the focus of Western Pennsylvania. And so that's what we're working to make those changes here. I think that there are a lot of people who are concerned about fracking, and those same people are looking at an alternative energy source, and solar is the answer for them. But we also, even in the fracking industry, people are using solar. So we see this crossing boundaries, political boundaries. So we have people from all political persuasions buying solar. It really crosses these boundaries now in ways that it other energy sources or have not done before.
What would you say are some of the major roadblocks when it comes to more fully using solar power? What would you say is holding back the development? Because even though you say in the last 5 years it's really grown, we're still not at the point where a lot of people are using this renewable energy.
Yeah, it's still a very small percent. And some of that is because of our leadership on the state and national level. But particularly in our state, as I mentioned, we were a leader several years ago, but all the states surrounding us have made more progressive commitments to investing in solar energy, where Pennsylvania has not done that. We're hopeful that Governor Wolf has made an announcement that he is committed to solar and increasing that. But we need our state legislature to also be committed to those same goals.
And I think overall general education of the viability, the affordability of solar energy in this region is probably been lacking. And here again, one of the purposes of Allegheny Solar Fest is to get people to come out so we can engage with them and talk to them about the viability.
Yeah, the cost of solar has dropped so dramatically over the last few years that now with a loan program, people can afford. It's really the choice of affording renting your electricity from the utility or buying solar energy, because they're about the same on a monthly basis.
And finally, what are some of the activities and features of the fest that people can look forward to?
Well, besides the points I've already mentioned about the experts that are going to be there, it's a lot of fun family activity there. We'll have a rock climbing wall for the kids. We're going to have solar-powered model car races, which are going to be cool little solar-powered cars. The Breathe Mobile, which is a mobile air quality lab, will come out and be able to people real-time information on the air quality right there. There'll be a free battery recycling. Of course, then there'll be live music throughout the day, food trucks. One of the local microbrews will be serving their beer there. So the whole day and event is both be educational and just fun.
It's the first Allegheny Solar Fest, and it's being held tomorrow at the borough of Millvale. And we've been talking with Sharon Piller. She's president of SunWIPA, Solar Unified Network of Western Pennsylvania, which is partnering with Greg Winks, who is the lead organizer of Allegheny Solar Fest, on this event. And it's been a pleasure talking to both of you, having you in our studios. Good luck with the event, and have a great summer.
Thank you great. So much,
Thank
Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, an endurance swimmer takes on his toughest test. It's the Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESN. It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Darren Miller has never backed away from a challenge, including the Ocean 7, composed of the English Channel, the North Channel, the Cook Strait, the Strait of Gibraltar, the Catalina Channel, the Suguru Strait, and the Molokai Channel. In 2013, Miller became the first athlete to conquer each of those seven long-distance open-water swims on the first try. But tomorrow, as remarkable as it may seem, Miller faces an even tougher challenge at Presque Isle State Park on Lake Erie. Beginning at 6 a.m., he will attempt the Sub-3 Squared Challenge as a benefit for his fiancée's 11-year-old cousin, who has been diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, a rare form of bone cancer. Miller would be the first athlete to complete the 26.2-mile marathon and 6.2-mile swim in the back-to-back format. He must finish each portion of the challenge in less than 3 hours. Adding to the difficulty, Miller must complete the swim without the help of a wetsuit or fins. He joins us now in studio. Darren Miller, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, great to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us is his fiancée, Ali DeFrancesco, who will be part of his crew. She is herself a cancer survivor who became the first Italian woman to successfully swim the English Channel. She holds dual U.S.-Italian citizenship. Ali DeFrancesco, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Paul.
Darren, let's start with you. What's involved in preparing and training for the Sub-3 Squared Challenge?
Well, Paul, it's a lot different than the past couple years of my life training for these long-distance open water swims, because the challenge from the start always was, you know, it's really cold in Pittsburgh and you can train yourself to acclimate to the cold water in January, February, March, April, give or take. But as we all know around Pittsburgh, and especially if you step outside on a day like today, it's quite warm and it's muggy. And as the summer goes on, the temperature rises. And the challenge I always faced was finding water cold enough during the months of June, July, August, which was typically the time frame when I completed these swims. Most of the pools that I swam in wouldn't be below 80 degrees. And sometimes the lake out at Keystone in Derry, Pennsylvania was roughly 85 degrees on its surface layer. And then the biggest challenge was then transitioning that and going over to waters like the English Channel or the Cook Strait, New Zealand, or the coldest was the North Channel between Northern Ireland and Scotland at roughly 53 degrees. So people can imagine what it's like to be in Pittsburgh when it's a really hot day and then all of a sudden you're jet set to Bangor, Northern Ireland, where it's in the 50s outside. It's maybe raining a little bit. People are in their parkas. And then all of a sudden you're walking into water that's roughly 30 degrees colder than anything you've been training in for the last 3 months. So it's a shock to the body. And one way to do that is you add a little bit of size. So for us that are landlocked, like such as here in Pittsburgh, we don't have an ocean to train in. You know, I needed to add a little bit of size to me, roughly 20 to 30 pounds, give or take, to my frame.
Right. You weighed how much when you were
training? At one point in my heaviest training for the North Channel, I was right around 235 pounds.
And you have lost how many pounds?
I've lost roughly about 50 pounds.
Specifically for this event?
Exactly, yes.
You look like a different guy.
Well, I appreciate that. I feel a lot better, too, so it's great.
You look good.
Thank you.
You look good.
Thank you.
Obviously, this is a different challenge, so you have to train differently. And as the first American man to complete the Ocean 7 Challenge, you've already accomplished some incredible tests of endurance. But how does the Sub-3 Squared Marathon compare with what you've faced in the past?
I mean, the biggest thing was when in 2009, when I first got 2008, 2009, when I was running marathons, when I got into endurance sports, when I graduated Penn State in 2005, I was 265 pounds. I started running in 2008 to get back into shape. And actually, over the period of the next year, lost roughly about 70 pounds at that point. I was about 190 pounds back in 2009. I injured myself, unfortunately, running. And then since then, I've added weight over the years to accomplish these swims. The big difference between then and now is the fact of you need to lose that size if you want to have speed. This challenge is you must be a fast runner. In order to run under 3-hour marathon, you're roughly going under 7-minute mile pace. So my goal with this, to do the first part, which is the marathon, is to go roughly about 250 to 255 in my marathon run and then essentially transition right in to the beach, run down the beach, essentially throw my suit on, goggles and earplugs, and then just jump right into the water from there.
Why Presque Isle?
Presque Isle is a beautiful place. Most people have no idea about Lake Erie. They know of it. They may have been there at one point in their past, but I love being an ambassador for it up there because, honestly, if you close your eyes, it feels like you're at the ocean. And that's the best we can get, being this close to Pittsburgh. So I always tell people, I say, go to Lake Erie. Presque Isle is an absolutely beautiful place. You know, we were up there for a race 2 weeks ago. Had a great time. Everybody was friendly, kind. You know, I can't wait to get back up there again. But the reason I chose Presque Isle is because we originally actually chose to go back towards San Diego and do this because I had issued a challenge to the triathlon community to see if anybody would want to race me, essentially a mono-mono race. Both of us can raise money for charities. We bring a lot of light to what we're doing and why we're doing it, more importantly. But unfortunately, nobody had stepped up, so now I'm doing it myself. So essentially, to save time, to save money, we decided to bring it back to Pittsburgh. And I figured, where am I going to do it? So the first place that I thought of would have been Lake Erie is a great place. And I was telling Allie about it, and then we went up there together, like I said, 2 weeks ago, and it's a great setting for this challenge.
And there's no jellyfish, there's no sharks.
There's nothing that's going to reach up and grab me or sting me, no. That's the good thing.
Like the Ocean 7 challenges, you're doing this as part of the Forever Fund, a charitable foundation that you've helped to establish. Remind our listeners about the mission of the Forever Fund.
Sure. The Ocean 7 challenges, all seven of them, benefited a fund at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. This fund went to assist the cardiothoracic ward at the hospital, specifically the families who needed assistance with the small costs, prescriptions, travel, food, lodging, the little things. So we assisted a lot of families over the years and raised roughly between what I've gathered around $75,000 to $100,000, which I'm very proud of. This challenge is directing what we decided to go and benefit Allie's 11-year-old cousin who lives down in Mississippi, to give her that energy, to give her that excitement to, you know, I'm going through a battle and she's going through a battle. Her battle is much more difficult than mine is, and I will ever understand. And the little thing that I can do is to help benefit her and to motivate her to keep continuing on through her challenge. So this challenge is benefiting a charity, which Allie can speak about, out of Colorado by the name of First Descents. And this charity is a cancer-related charity that we are doing in honor of her cousin Julia.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Darren Miller, who will attempt the Sub-3 Squared Challenge as a benefit for his fiance's 11-year-old cousin, who has been diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, a rare form of bone cancer. Also with us is his fiance, who is also an accomplished athlete, Allie DeFrancesco, a dual U.S.-Italian citizen and the first Italian woman to swim the English Channel. Allie DeFrancesco, what made you want to swim the English Channel?
That's a good place to start. Thank you for asking. In April of 2009, when I should have been graduating with my class at New York University, Yankee Stadium, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this was only 3 weeks after my college swim coach at NYU, Lauren Beam, had been diagnosed with colon cancer. And she was 5 months pregnant. Both of us had been in and out of the doctor's office, her for prenatal care and myself with just back-to-back sinus infections that doctors couldn't seem to find an answer for. And still the news was quite a shock. And fast forward, following extensive chemotherapy, radiation, and a bone marrow transplant, I was still yet to be called in remission. The doctors told me only time will tell. And in September 2011, Lauren, actually, she passed away. And I went back to her memorial. I'd been living in San Diego at the time, following NYU. And she, I couldn't help but feel that it was such a roll of the die. And I wanted to do something in her memory to say thank you when you can't say thank you enough, to have that coach-athlete relationship where the coach will do anything to protect their athletes and to give them the best opportunity possible. And I felt just uniquely blessed with this opportunity to take a very negative series of events and do something momentously positive in honor of Lauren, for myself, and to show those who are in a situation where I could very easily be, that someone's out there fighting for them. And to do something as universally understood as challenging. Cancer affects everyone, either directly or indirectly, for no apparent reason. And I believe that, you know, life gives us experiences and we are who we are by how we deal with them. And when I was in the hospital, I just, you know, I've never felt so alone. But again, so cancer is understood. English Channel, there's a game piece in the game of life that says swim the English Channel. It is universally understood. You say cancer, nobody knows what goes into it. It's so individual, but they get it. You say English Channel, nobody knows what goes into it, the complexities, the logistics, but they have an idea that it's virtually, quote unquote, impossible. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I was a sprinter through college, but I wrote a letter to my club swim coach back in San Diego, Joe Jamin, who's been coaching me since I was 12. And I said, hey, this is my plan. What do you think? And he said, let's go for it. And That's it.
Was your training different from someone with no history of cancer?
No. I never wanted to be defined by the C word. There were a lot of shows on TV where people used it as an excuse, I felt. And I don't think so.
Explain to us what First Descents is.
First Descents is an organization out of Denver that takes young adult cancer patients and survivors on outdoor adventures around the world to encourage them to defy their illness and regain their lives through outdoor adventure, and showing them that life is beautiful, and doing that with a sense of community with other people who have been through a similar experience without the tragedy.
How did First Descents motivate you to swim the English Channel?
You know, it is so near and dear to my heart because, like I said, it's something that I think without really admitting it at first, it was something I was doing for myself. And I found out pretty quickly that there's something so fulfilling about waking up and doing what you can while you can and being able to pay it forward and give back and fight for people who you can never imagine what they're going through, but you have a pretty good idea and you could easily be there yourself.
Describe to us how you felt the moment you reached the shore.
Oh, boy. Well, it had been 2 years coming, and I put every dime, nickel, penny, ounce of energy. I was working a full-time job. I went over in 2012. I got blown out from inclement weather and had to return home, recommitted, and had success on August 28th of 2013. And it could not have been more beautiful. It was like an out-of-body experience where from the moment that the boat pilot said, "Let's go, you're going tomorrow," it was just, this is it. This is my chance. And feeling, you know, lifted up by all those people who motivated me and my coach and my grandparents and my great aunt and people who have since passed and my friends at home, my training partners, and just all of that work, waking up at 4:30 a.m. every day, swimming for 3 hours, going to work at 8:30, getting home at 5:30, going to the gym again or going to the pool again. I mean, it's a lot of work. And it's just surreal, really.
A few years ago when you were in the middle of treatments, could you have imagined being where you are today?
No. There was a moment during my bone marrow transplant where I was in a negative pressure chamber at UCLA Medical in Santa Monica, and people actually had to put on a gown in a separate room before entering my room, where I am literally attached to the wall by cords. And I had a stationary bike in my room where the doctors had to remove it. And they said, "Sweetheart, you will kill yourself." And I just remember that. And I think with blood cancers right now, the treatment poses a greater threat to the human existence than the cancer itself. And understanding that to the fullest extent took a really long time. And the bone marrow transplant, of course, was towards the near end of my treatment. But I just remember being in there with Rare, a visitor, and just looking around at the stark white walls and saying, you know what, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that Allie's happy.
Is there anything that you would like to say to those battling cancer who might be feeling like they will never be active again? What would your message to them be?
You know, my heart goes out to them. And right now, I mean, Julia is my new hero. The fact that she should have been graduating with her fifth grade class, and instead she's losing her hair and in treatment every day and in trials. It's something that I have some experience, but I will never understand. And most people won't. And my coach, Lauren, was receiving treatment the same day as my first treatment. And she'd already had, I think, one or two before me. And we spoke on the phone. It was really the last time that we spoke. There was a certain disconnect that developed. And she said two things, though. She said, one, try and stay positive. She said, be you, be Allie D. That was my nickname on the swim team. And funny enough, I come to find out that my blood type's actually B positive. And when they told me that, and I was a little bit pessimistic at the time, and I was like, go figure. I mean, that's B positive. Here it is again. All right. Well, I guess I better have no choice now. And then the second thing she said was, don't hang on to what the doctors tell you. And actually, 6 months after I was first diagnosed, and the doctor who I was initially receiving treatment with had told me, we're going for the cure, we're going for the cure. He told my parents that, we're going for the cure. And I go in after my supposed last session of chemo, and he said, so it didn't work. And I come to find out that I was significantly underdiagnosed and just was a completely different level of treatment that was needed. And so those two things, just to keep that in mind and to really be an advocate for yourself and getting to know yourself is one of the coolest things to learn that at a young age. I feel so grateful for.
Darren, talk about why Julia is special to you.
Well, I think whenever Allie and I first decided about 6 months ago that I was going to pursue this and challenge this, and I really took to it, I knew I wanted to do it for a charity. And at the time, I just assumed I'd probably do it for mine at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. And obviously, not to take anything away from that, it's an amazing charity and an amazing place, and absolutely love it still. In my future, I will continue to raise money for the Forever Fund at the hospital. But I believe that after Allie and I now have built our lives together and will continue into the future, I think what it comes down to is this is something that I learned from her by exactly what she just explained to you is something that means the world to her. And the way I look at it is this is someone close. This is somebody personal that we have in contact with. I personally have never met Julia. I look forward to the day that I can. Her smile is contagious. It's absolutely beautiful. And when you see a little girl like that, your heart melts. And this is exactly the reason why I've always done what I do, because it's to represent those who aren't able to go out and do it right now and to understand in life that every breath is a gift and we should be using everything we can to try to make the world a better place. It's the way that I've been doing it since the beginning. And I look at this as an amazing way to really bring Allie and I and bring myself closer to her family and to do something, again, very positive to help just really bring that motivation forth for this little girl who's fighting right now.
And how are you raising funds? How does it work?
Essentially right now, the website I will give the listeners is basically through the First Descents website. The internet address is support.firstdescents.org/channeledin. And that's at the end. It's spelled C-H-A-N-N-E-L-E-D-I-N. So that website is the donation page where anyone listening is able to go online and make that tax-deductible donation to First Descents and can read more about Julia, see a picture of her, and just really follow along tomorrow as I make this attempt.
And we'll have a link to that on our website at WESA.FM. Before we wrap this up, I have to ask you, it's a tough question, but it must be asked. What happens if you don't make it? This is an incredible challenge.
First of all, Paul, I'm sure you've realized after speaking to me a couple times over the years that that kind of thought doesn't cross my mind. I do not believe that I will not accomplish this. There's nothing but positive vibes. I feel great. I feel strong. You know, the water's a little bit cooler right now. It's about 60 degrees up there, so it's a little chilly. But the bottom line is I know that I have Allie with me. I have my great friend Josh, who is acting as crew chief along with Allie, and friends and family who are there for my support. So there's not a question of a doubt that I will finish this race and I will complete what I said I was going to do.
And Allie, how do you plan to help him through it?
Smiling. It's amazing what one smile can do for another person. And as I get to know Darren more and more, I know that he appreciates that. Of course, there's a logistics, but really that's my strategy.
We've been talking with Darren Miller, who will attempt the Sub-3-Squared Challenge as a benefit for his fiancée's 11-year-old cousin, who has been diagnosed with Ewing's sarcoma, a rare form of bone cancer. Also with us, his fiancée, who is going to be supporting him tomorrow in his effort to accomplish this feat. And she is an accomplished athlete herself, the first Italian woman to swim the English Channel. Darren Miller, Allie DeFrancesco, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh, and good luck.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer saying, have a good weekend, everyone.